Thank you, Mr. Oliver. As Mr. Dunn has said, it is a cold December day out there, and there's a lot of weather out there that is making news. And my sister lives up in Olympia, Washington, and she's talked about how the weather up there has flooded roads. And as you might have read in the news, you couldn't get up to Seattle from Portland for quite a number of days because of the flooding across the roads. And I just, with all the cold that we're having here, I just assumed that we were going to have the deepest snow we've ever had. And I'm still waiting. Rachel said to me this morning, do you think we should pray for lots of snow tonight? Some people like snow. Some people don't. So I said, it might be a good idea. She goes, why did you say might? I said, well, because some people aren't as happy with the snow as others. Some people don't like to drive in it. Some people don't like to shovel it. But it sure is fun to look at. Well, you know, if you spend any time out this time of year, it seems like the whole world is marching to the beat of a different drummer. People are busy scurrying about, doing Christmas shopping, preparing for the holiday that's coming up. And, you know, no matter how hectic it gets for these people, no matter how much people gripe about how crowded the stores are, how expensive everything is, how much debt they go in, the problems that they have trying to get along when all the family comes together, it would never dawn on any of these people to say, let's just pack it all in. It just wouldn't come up to their mind. I mean, even if you got in a discussion about how commercialized everything is, and boy, wouldn't it be simpler if they would never give up the holiday of Christmas. You know, most people don't want to talk about whether or not to celebrate the day. Some might cite religious reasons, while others look at some of the good that is accomplished this time of year. There are food drives, there are organizations that help people who are in need, who are homeless, or who need clothing, and there's a lot of goodwill and charity that happens at this time of the year. And they would hate to see all of that good done under. So all of us, in our own ways, have studied and proved to ourselves that Christmas is not the holiday that God would like us to do. But yet, if you get in a conversation with somebody out there, you're not going to convince them. Their mind is made up, and our mind is made up. So why should we care? Why should we talk about it at all? If we're convinced and they're convinced, why should we even go down this road? Well, a few weeks ago we heard Mr. Kylo talk in a recent message about how each of us should go over the basics again in our lives and reprove the things that we once did to strengthen our foundation. 2 years ago I covered this subject from a historical point of view. And I did so because something happened to me at work. Somebody had asked me something about my faith. I gave an answer. And he said, I didn't know that Christmas wasn't in the Bible. I just assumed it was. He was somebody who had not spent any time in church in his life. And I started thinking, I wonder how many people didn't know that Christmas is not in the Bible. I mean, obviously we did. And so I did a study. And the sermon I did 2 years ago basically focused on where Christianity arrived and where it is today. How did it start from what we read about in our Bibles and convert itself into what we see today? I talked about how the fracturing between the Jewish people and the Christians of the day, how the anti-Semitism and the problems between the Romans and the Jews during the Jewish wars drove a wedge between the Jews and the Christians, and how the Christians tried to distance themselves from the Jews by removing everything that looked or felt Jewish. And when that division was good and seated, they were well open for the idea of bringing in new ideas and new thoughts. And when Constantine organized his kingdom, it was very easy to interject all these different beliefs into one package. And so we talked about that, and we talked about how ideas that we have today came from those times long ago. I'd been watching, a few weeks ago I watched one of the Beyond Today programs that were on the internet that UCG puts out on the topic of Christmas, and they covered a lot of that information as well. And I was thinking about the fact that, you know, if people could understand this, I think they'd have a completely different perspective on this holiday. But as I think back to my own experiences, people don't want to hear about history. Most people don't care. You know, you start telling them about something that happened 300, 400, 1,000, 2,000 years ago, they don't care. And then I had an experience that sort of got me thinking about this topic in a different length, different light. It started by some news articles that I had seen recently. And you may have seen some of these before. Oh, here's one from CNN.com. It talks about Sudan protesters and arresting a teacher. And here it says, hundreds of angry protesters, some waving ceremonial swords from trucks equipped with loudspeakers, gathered Friday outside the presidential palace to denounce a teacher whose class named a teddy bear Mohammed. Some of you may have heard of this in the news. Some calling for her execution. The protesters, which witnesses had said numbered close to 1,000, swore to fight in the name of their prophet. Gillian Gibbons, 54, was given 15 days in jail late Thursday after she was convicted of insulting the religion. She was cleared of charges of inciting hatred and showing contempt for religious beliefs, but her jail time was upheld. And as we read later in stories that came out after this, she was finally released as the British government put a lot of pressure on the Sudanese government, and she was pardoned after about 4 days in jail. So when you see things like this, you think, wow, this is extreme. I'm sure glad we don't have things like that in our country. And then there was this other story. I pulled this off of CBS News. It's titled, Saudi Rape Victim Gets 200 Lashes. It's another one of these astounding stories that you just can't wrap your mind around. A Saudi court sentenced a woman who had been gang raped to 6 months in jail and 200 lashes, more than doubling her initial penalty for being in a car with a man who was not a relative, newspaper reported Thursday. The victim had initially been sentenced to 90 lashes after being convicted, of her violating Saudi's rigid laws of segregation of the sexes. Under Saudi Arabia's interpretation of Islamic Sharia law, women are not allowed in public in the company of men other than male relatives. The court also banned her lawyer from defending her, confiscated his license to practice law, and summoned him to a disciplinary hearing later this month. The initial sentence for the men convicted of the gang rape ranged from 10 months to 5 years, and their sentence range now, after reviewing the case, they actually doubled their sentences from 2 to 9 years for this brutal crime. So what did this woman do that was so horrible that she broke Islamic law? The attack took place in 2006. The woman has said that it occurred as she tried to retrieve her picture from a male high school student that she used to know. While in the car with the student, two men got into the vehicle and drove them to a secluded area where she was raped there by 7 men, 3 of whom attacked her friend. Reports of the story triggered debate across Saudi Arabia's legal system, in which judges have wide discretion in punishing criminal rules of evidence and are shaky, and sometimes no defense lawyers are present. So when we see stories like this coming out of third world countries, we think, that's terrible. I'm sure glad it's not that way here. And, of course, it got me thinking when I read those stories about the passage in the Bible. If you'll turn over to John 8, about where religious law kind of hits really close to home. John 8, and we'll start in verse 1. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Now early in the morning, he came again to the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and the Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses, in the law, commanded us that one should be stoned. But what do you say? It's obvious here that the scribes and the Pharisees were trying to pin Jesus between the Judaic law and the Roman law, because the Judaic law called for capital punishment, and capital punishment was banned under Roman law. And they wanted to see how Jesus was going to get his way out of that. And of course, Jesus being God is not going to be trapped by mere humans. And so in verse 6, they said this, testing him that they might have something of which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger, as though he did not hear. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Those who heard it, being convicted in their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest to the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had raised himself up and saw that no one but the woman was there, he said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" So what got me thinking about this scripture is the fact that Jesus was put on the spot over a religious principle. And it got to me thinking about a time just recently that I was put on the spot for a religious principle. And how, even though we look at what happened in the Middle East as being extreme, as being something that we could not imagine happening in our courts, I believe there's a time coming where some of this extremism is going to make its way back into our courts, and we may be called to account for almost anything. And we have to be prepared for what's out there. And the idea that we have a court system that is fair is something that we've enjoyed, but we may not have it indefinitely. The time I was put on the spot was just about 6 weeks ago. I was assigned to go to a workshop. I talked to some of you about this a few weeks ago. But this was a workshop in creating a respectful and positive workplace. And my boss thought it was a good idea that a number of us from the department go, because when you have a lot of people working together, things can get less than positive. People can get negative attitudes and whatnot. He thought this would be a good way for all of us to kind of work on some of the things that we don't kind of give the department a bad name. If, you know, especially when you have people that work inside, away from the public a lot, they get kind of cavalier about things that they say and do. So we went to this workshop. It was a two-part workshop, where the first part, there was a lot of us from the department in, and the information they covered was fairly good stuff. It was referring to things like jokes that are inappropriate that people hear from time to time, some of the stereotyping that people do. People tend to think of who they're comfortable around and who they're not comfortable around, and then they will say inappropriate things and make the workplace not fun for those they don't agree with. And so I didn't have any real apprehensions going to part two of this. Unfortunately, none of the people that I worked with were there the second time. It was just me from my group. And I wasn't really prepared when I walked in there to how the topics were going to change in the second meeting. Right before the first meeting was over, she asked, "What kind of things should we cover next time?" And I raised my hand and said, "You know, we've talked a lot about things that are negative that we should avoid in the workplace, and those are all good. What I'd like to see is things that we can add in a positive way to add to the workplace that would be, something. You can't make a positive workplace by just removing negative. You have to put something positive in its place." And she agreed and said, "Okay, that's what we're going to talk about when we get back." So when we started the next class, it started off that way, and then it quickly changed. It was like a spirit in the room had changed, and she's changed gears within about 5 minutes. It was very strange. The topics immediately went from adding positive things to the workplace to learning to accept diversity in all of its many forms. Our moderator spent a large time talking about the four steps to embracing diversity. Nowhere in the syllabus was this mentioned that this was something that's going to be talked about. And she talked about these four steps. The first one, of course, is tolerance. They talk about a lot. The next one is acceptance. The third step is respect. And the fourth step is advocacy. And she talked about her alternative lifestyle and her quest for acceptance in her own family and how she helped others to follow these steps and how those that don't are the ones that have a problem. I finally spoke up and said that those words that she used had meanings far beyond their dictionary definitions and had taken on political meanings that are the ones that come to mind before any meanings that she was talking about. And she wanted me to give her an example of what I mean because she couldn't understand why these words were could all be objectionable. So I thought for a minute and I thought, how could I say this without saying anything that's going to bring condemnation on me? And so I just came up with the idea I would substitute a vegetarian into this model and say, I just talk about that. I said, you know, I can tolerate a vegetarian even though I'm a meat eater. I have no problem tolerating vegetarians. I have no problem accepting them as people. And, you know, I can even respect them as individuals, but I cannot see a world where I'm going to become an advocate of vegetarianism. And, you know, she thought that was interesting. And she says, why? And I said, because I heard somebody say once that if God intended for people not to eat animals, he wouldn't have made them out of meat. So I got a laugh, but more important, it made the moderator switch gears. She kind of didn't know where to go with that. And so she said, okay, well, we'll go on to something else. Then she handed out a list of scenarios of common workplace problems and situations that people get into. And she said, we're going to break into groups and we're going to talk about these different things. And we're going to come up with, you know, kind of work plans to get over some of the sticky problems that happen in the workplace. And one of them was on a situation where two women in the office were Hispanic, and they spent a lot of time speaking Spanish. And somebody in the office comes in and complains, thinks that the women speaking Spanish are speaking about her. And then there was another one about somebody, you know, doing inappropriate jokes and whatnot. And she picked on different people to read different scenarios, and then we talked about each one. And then she handed me this one scenario, and she says, I'd like you to read this one. And I was given the following question. You are planning an office Christmas party. You are planning an office Christmas party when you are made aware of an employee that does not celebrate Christmas and does not want to attend. Everyone in the room, I was picked for this question. What do you do so that person feels comfortable attending the party? That was my assignment. She probably assumed I would be on the pro-Christmas side, and being somebody who shut her down on the tolerance tact, she was going to get me pinned on this one. So I thought about it. I thought, I wonder what answer she's looking for. What answer does she think is the right answer? And then related to that, what would be wrong with that answer? So I said after I read the question, and then she said, what could I include or change in the celebration so that everyone would feel welcome? I wanted to say that dressing up Christmas to make it more palatable is like putting lipstick on a pig, but I didn't. So what I said actually is, I didn't keep Christmas, and if you truly want to make me comfortable with the Christmas party, then you wouldn't force me to attend. It's as simple as that. And she said, what if we make it a winter party? If it's a winter party, you should have no problem in it. And I said, I know. What if we really do make it a winter party? But instead of making it in December, we'll make it February 1st. I'll be there. And she says, well, why can't we make it in December? And I said, well, why do you want to make it in December? Winter is winter. Of course, I doubt anyone in the office would want to attend a February winter party. You wouldn't find those people can't wait to plan, can't wait to decorate, can't wait to do all the things. And it would not gain any real any momentum on its own for people to go and try to do a winter party in February. She says, well, what if we included your views in with the day? And we'll make everything about Christmas. We'll make the Christmas party, we'll make it a Hanukkah party, we'll make it a solstice party, we'll invite the Wiccans, you know, and we'll just put everything in the pot. And then everyone can feel, you know, Kwanzaa, everyone can feel comfortable. And I thought, that's how Christmas got started in the first place. You know, you never know if you're going to be put on a spot or not. Sometimes you see people talking about religious topics and you think, I'm not going to get involved with that. I can't change them. What's the point? And most of the time you're right. A lot of times religious discussions are basically just arguments in disguise. And when you start talking about things, you start throwing scriptures around or people start getting upset. And they always say politics and religion are the two things you should never talk about in the workplace. But there are times that we will be put on the spot. And if Satan has anything to say about it, I think those times will be early and often. You know, I would like to spend the rest of the time today talking about the debate that's going on over Christmas today. You know, we have all looked at it individually. We've all made up our minds how we feel about it. And I'm sure a lot of us have stories of people we've tried to talk to and convince. And I remember my family on my dad's side, it was all Mormon, and Christmas was big for them. And my parents made no progress trying to convince them that Christmas wasn't the way to go. And so you think, to some extent, the argument of whether or not people should or shouldn't keep Christmas is kind of a dead issue. But I'd like to talk about sort of what I am seeing as a resurgence of this topic. The title for today is The Battle for Christmas. And the battle isn't going on in places that you would expect. See, 2 years ago when I was doing all the research, I found lots of information from websites, from organizations that we are either in or were or close to. And we know some of the material that's out there. But I found a lot of information from people that go to church on Sunday, that believe you go to heaven on the instance of death, that believe in the Trinity in one form or the other, and they are out there railing against Christmas. And for all the years that we've done it in the Church of God, you get a certain amount of feedback, you get a certain amount of reaction. But you know, Mr. Dick was talking at the feast about some of these new evangelical and mega churches that are popping up, and some of them are taking a new look at the scriptures. And when they do, they are starting to talk about things that we used to think, hey, that was what we used to talk about. And these are Sunday keeping groups. And when they start talking about Christmas, other Christian organizations begin to listen. You never usually see very much in the way of responses from the Protestant Catholic crowd over people who don't want to believe in Christmas. Because it's sort of like politics. The front runner, if they're way ahead of everybody else, they generally don't even mention that they have opponents. Because if you don't mention them, pretty much they get no press and the ideas go away. But if somebody starts getting close, somebody starts threatening your territory, that's when you feel like you need to respond. And I'm starting to see responses from some pretty large organizations over this topic. And so there is a battle for Christmas that's going on today. It's starting. It's not huge, but I expect it to get much bigger. I would like to read you six justifications that I took from this give and take on the battle of keeping Christmas or not from Sunday keeping Christians who disagree on the topic. The first three are from people and groups that support Christmas and try to find an answer. Arguments and answer critics about justifying their beliefs. The last three justifications are from those that used to keep Christmas even recently and have realized that it's not what they should be doing anymore. The first one I got from an excerpt article that Mr. Walker gave me from the website Bible.org. It's from a pastor there. His name is J. Hampton Keeley III. He's a Dallas Theological Seminary graduate and a former pastor of 28 years. And he had in his later years started to address this. I went through a lot of his works, and a lot of his early works are things that you would expect coming from a Protestant pastor, but there started to become more and more articles he started writing on Christmas because of this battle that's going on. And so the first thing he addresses in this article was, some question the origin of the modern Christmas tree. And so he writes in his article to defend the Christmas tree. He says, regardless, the Christmas tree has become a part of our season, and any pagan connections to it originally may have been were lost long ago, just as were the names of the days of the week, which are also have a pagan origin, or the names of the months. So he says, you know, January is was named after a pagan god, and we still use January, so we can use the Christmas tree. That's his argument. At any rate, Christians believe we can use this season in a positive way to remember the birth of the Savior, who he is, and why he came to the world. He says a number of Old Testament passages are sometimes used to condemn the use of the Christmas tree, such as Jeremiah 10. I'd like you to turn over to that. When I first read Jeremiah 10 a number of years ago, I wrote it in my Bible. I put different topics that I come up with that I want to be able to pull up the topics quickly. So I'll put a number of scriptures on different topics. So if I need to go and find something, I can find it. And I came across Jeremiah 10. And I thought, wow, this does sound like the Christmas tree. Jeremiah 10 and verse 1, I'll just read it here. It says, hear the word of the Lord. Hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the Gentiles are dismayed by them. The customs of the people are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of which the hands of the workmen with an axe. They decorate it in silver and gold, and they fasten it with nails and hammers so it will not topple. They are upright like a palm tree, and they cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor can they do any good. Of course, if you study into this, you realize they weren't putting up a Christmas tree in their house. They were taking the trees and they were cutting them into idols. And they were worshiping those idols. And so this author goes and said, see, this is a wrong scripture to be used, because it's not referring to Christmas trees, it's referring to idols. And he says that he and his faith condemns the use of idols in any form, and so therefore this is a dead argument. But you know, reading from a UCG booklet, Holidays of Holy Days, it says in the following verses, 3 through 5, God describes some of their idolatrous customs. They cut a tree from the forest, shape it with an axe, overlay it with precious metals. It says, although this account is specifically referring to the making of an idol, verses 6 through 8 tells us in God's command verses 6 through 8 refer to more of it looking more like a person than it does a tree. God's command, do not learn the way of the Gentiles, applies to all pagan customs. Christmas trees, mistletoe, colorful lights, that all come from pagan winter solstice celebrations. Rabbits and Easter eggs are fertility symbols, and demonic concepts at Halloween all fit this prohibition. In giving this instruction against learning the way of the Gentiles, God wanted his people to avoid this type of sin their forefathers had committed with the golden calf. And it is true that if you get into a discussion with some Christian and the topic of Jeremiah 10 comes, that person will be ready for you. He'll be saying, oh, I wait for him to try to call this a Christmas tree. I'm going to nail him. And so, as I said before, some of these discussions aren't always fruitful. But, you know, look down in Jeremiah 10. Look down to verse 15. This, to me, is what really needs to be talked about here. Because if you go through the entire Jeremiah 10, 1 through 15, you start reading how Jeremiah is summing up all of the belief systems of the Gentile nations. They pull out astrology. They pull out signs and wonders that they all fall down and believe are from their false gods. They pull down different things like idol worship and sacrifice and all these different things. And all the way through to verse 15, it talks about how these customs get these people nowhere. And then in verse 15, it says, they are futile, a work of errors. In the time of their punishment, they shall perish. And I was looking at this, and I found a different version, and that really kind of spoke to me. So I went and I pulled out 4 different versions here of the Bible on Jeremiah 10:15. I'd like to read them one by one and just kind of give you a flavor of what this is actually saying. In the NIV, it says, "They are worthless, the objects of mockery. When their judgment comes, they will perish." The New Jerusalem Bible says, "They are futile, a laughable production. When the time comes for them to be punished, they will vanish." The New Living Translation says, "Idols are worthless, they are lies. The time is coming when they will all be destroyed." And the New Revised Standard says, "They are worthless, a work of delusion. At the time of their punishment, they shall perish." When you start reading these different versions and see the different ways that all these practices that these people kept are viewed by God, it's really hard to wrap your mind around the idea that God would say, well, as long as you don't look at it the way they did, I'm okay with it. Because we are going to put in history books 1,000 years from now on how ridiculous those things are. And we're not going to be keeping practices that mimic those ridiculous customs. You know, the idol worship did infect God's people. In the time of Jeremiah, when this was written, the people had started to do some of these very things that we see talked about. When Christians today say, well, that was all pagan idol worship, we don't believe in that, God's people were sucked in by that. In the time of Jeremiah, these people were putting up idols in their house. They were doing sacrifices to those idols. They were trying to keep the enemy at bay, doing anything they possibly could besides turn to God. And it turns God's stomach. So what do you think God's going to do when people come up in the resurrection from ancient Israel and they said, hey, wait a minute, I'm seeing people today mimicking the things that we got in trouble for. Do you think God's going to say, well, I know where you're going with that, but it's not like that? I don't think so. The next thing Mr. Keith Lee said in his article, he answers the question, is it okay to teach Santa Claus to your kids? This is, to me, was flabbergasting, his reasoning that he used through here. And I'm going to read to you some excerpts of some of the things. The article was much longer, and I'm just cherry-picking some of the points that get, you know, that get to it pretty quickly. But it just really hit home to what the attitude in Christianity today as far as accepting things that are just terrible. He says, some Christians claim that teaching about Santa Claus is wrong because Christmas can involve children in the belief of Santa Claus, a mythical figure, which detracts from the person of Christ. The objection is that the emphasis is turned from Jesus Christ to Santa Claus, and as a giver of gifts for good behavior rather than God's gift to a son by grace through faith. And so what he's saying is, if you just teach children, number one, that you can just give lots of gifts and all you get is lots of presents, that you are implying that God's gift to us is not a free, unmerited gift for nothing that we do, because they teach that we need to be good givers as well as good receivers at Christmas. And, of course, he talks about that, and the answer really isn't that important as he covers that area. But the part that I focused in on was the idea of believing in a mythical figure and teaching them such. He says, furthermore, young children sometimes confuse Santa with Jesus Christ, since he knows when you've been sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he knows that you've been good or bad. So he asks, how should believers handle it? He said, Santa may be taken as a fairy tale, like Alice in Wonderland or Jack and the Beanstalk. Children normally understand that Alice in Wonderland is only make-believe, a fairy tale. So, however, for many children, Santa is real. And in many ways, it is probably harmless. That's what he says. It's probably harmless. But because of the confusion between Santa and Christ, parents need to be careful in their use of this part of Christmas. So is he saying, it's probably harmless, so that's therefore if you do it, you're okay. But if it isn't harmless, then you probably shouldn't. He says, the Santa Claus idea originated with a man named St. Nicholas, who was a Catholic bishop in the area of present-day Turkey. He went on about, he went about often at night giving gifts to the poor and needy children. He later became the patron saint of children. From there, the story grew and became legend in the, country, and in country after country with various details were deleted or added as the legend grew. As with all of these doubtful things, he says, each family needs to make their own minds up. In my opinion, parents can explain the traditions and have fun with them, but make sure that your children understand the historic roots of these things and to teach them the truth behind the traditions. So I was confused when I read that, and I thought, okay, if you teach the children the truth about Santa Claus, then what's the point of telling them that he's coming down the chimney? You know, what's the point of putting up milk and cookies and putting up stockings on the fireplace? If you just told the kids it's all a big lie and it's just mom and dad staying up till midnight the night before, then what's the point of even going into it? He's trying to have it both ways. I found a reference to an article in December 23rd, 2004, article in Newsday. Reporter Denise Flame talked to an Ithaca College professor of psychology who studies children's attitudes about Santa. Professor Cindy Shy points out, who tells you Santa Claus is not real? It's usually somebody you don't trust or somebody who's not particularly trustworthy, like an older brother. She says, who tells you that he does exist? Your parents, your grandparents, maybe people in your church. So when you find out that Santa Claus is not real, what does that do to your trust center for your children? The reporter then interviewed Professor Cindy Clark, who studies human development at Pennsylvania State University. Clark interviewed youngsters who still believe in Santa Claus and found that children had various ways of connecting Santa Claus and God, like God gave Santa his job, or the way Santa Claus knows if you've been good or bad is because God tells him. So they link, these children link their belief in God and their belief in Santa. What happens when they find out Santa isn't real? What happens to their belief in God? See, you take down one half of their belief system. See, this is what Satan loves about mixing these different ideas. So the third argument that comes from a group that pertains to keep Christmas and thinks that it's okay, to me is kind of puts the nail in the coffin, per se, of this topic from this point of view. It's an article called Christmas is Not Pagan. It's from a website called Our Redeemer Lutheran Church, and it's from Pastor Harold Lynn. This is from one of the bigger groups, and it's just really boggled my mind that somebody of a religious persuasion could have these viewpoints. He writes, their argument is Christmas is obviously pagan because there is neither biblical command or precedent for it. Christians did not observe it until the time of Constantine after 313 AD. Only then did the Church of Rome introduce it. The date of Christmas and many of its customs all come from pagan sources. And when Christians observe Christmas, in a way, they are participating in paganism. And I thought, yeah, that sounds about right. But this is what he writes. It is my position that Christmas is certainly not pagan, though many customs, have gravitated to the Christmas, have had pagan origins. Therefore, in this article, I would like to respond to those that argue that Christmas is pagan. I will attempt to show that though at times their facts are correct, in most cases their logic is not, which causes them to make false assumptions and conclusions repeatedly. The article, I can tell you, was very long, many, many pages, and I wasn't sure how much I would be used because he would go on two or three pages to prove a point that may or may not make any sense at all. When he got to the end, when he started summing it up, is where I really couldn't believe, and I started just grabbing whole paragraphs that he was writing. Right toward the end, in other words, just because we use similar customs doesn't mean that in every case that these are directly derived from pagan religions. Cultures all over the world have used lights and trees, gift-giving and revelry in their celebrations. Why is it assumed that because Christians use these things at Christmas that they have taken them directly from paganism? If it is discovered that pagans drank milk or hugged their families at a pagan festival, does this mean that Christians can't do so? But this is the kind of logic that the anti-Christmas crowd uses. Of course, some Christmas customs are certainly taken from paganism. The use of the word Yule and various associated customs come from pagan culture. It is thought that among Anglo-Saxons, the time of winter solstice was a time of a great feast. But so what? Is everything that was once used by paganism centuries ago now off limits when Christians apply them to Christmas or other Christian festivals? He said it. I mean, let me read it again. So what? Is everything that was once used by paganism centuries ago now off limits when Christians apply them to Christmas or other Christian festivals? Are we prepared to strictly apply that to everything we do? I am. But he says, why can't we use some of the same words, symbols, or customs which long ago ceased to be used in the worship of false gods? I mean, this is the Lutheran Church. Now, I'm sure he's not speaking for everybody in the Lutheran Church, but he is saying it right here. Why can't we use things that were used for worshiping false gods? Turn to Deuteronomy 12. I don't know that we need to publish another booklet. We should just start publishing his stuff. we're probably gain more from that. But turn to Deuteronomy 12, and starting in verse 30. It says, take heed to yourselves that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I will do so likewise. And then it really says it right here in verse 31. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. So he's not saying don't just follow after other gods. He's not saying as long as you don't pretend that they're pagan, you're okay. He's saying whatever they did, I don't want you to do that for me. And why? For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it, that you shall not add to it nor take away from it. You know, it's interesting when you read some of these study papers from mainstream Christian organizations, they love to say, oh, well, that's the law, and the law was done away with. It doesn't apply to us. So the fact that it was the law that was done away with, I guess, undoes the fact that God hates it. I mean, how do you reconcile that in your mind? God said he hates it. And they said, well, it was done away with, so it doesn't really count anymore. So those are three arguments that people that profess Christmas is a good thing are saying that it's okay. And I pulled three out of probably just seven or eight that I had to choose from, and they all talked about just about every aspect of Christmas that you could think of, and some of them were more clear than others, and I picked the three that I thought best stated the point. Now I'd like to give you three arguments that were put forth by Christians who no longer keep Christmas. These are people that not too many months or years ago were in the midst of keeping Christmas and have learned since that this isn't the way to do it. And what's interesting here isn't the fact that they could figure things out the same as we can. That's not the interesting part. They have a unique perspective of being in the middle of these other Christian groups. They were sitting in the pews where they would talk about why Christmas was good. And they would hear the multitude of sermons. These aren't people that went through and found a couple different articles here or there, or somebody said this once upon a time, and therefore it's bad. These are people that were there living the life day after day, year after year, hearing the sermons talking about how good Christmas was. And so they summed up some major points of what Christians today justify Christmas from their point of view. And I just picked three of them. The first one is, some say that Christmas provides a festive time to share the gospel. A lot of churches talk about how if you get a chance to preach, you take it. You know, they use the argument that Paul went up to Mars Hill in the midst of all the false gods. And he said, I have no problem talking with these people in the midst of their pagan celebration and to talk to them about their faith. And he used that as a vehicle to bring up the real God. And so they said, if Paul can do it, what's the difference of us doing it? It's an opportunity to preach, and we should take it whenever we can. The argument, these people go on to say, that Satan works to blend together his system with God's system. Because when unacceptable worship, paganism, is blended with true worship, God's truth, true worship is destroyed. Now, we know that. But it's interesting. People who keep Christmas for religious reasons, this is the Super Bowl for them. This is the big deal. This is the big show. And after service, they talk about all the good that they can do. But what I'd like to propose to you today is that the truth is the best that Christmas has to offer, although it certainly is better than a lot of the evil that goes on in the world today. And I can understand why people would grasp at anything good in a world that is so surrounded by evil. The best that it has to offer cannot hold a candle to God's plan for mankind. You know, when I think about Christmas, I remember keeping it myself when I was just a year or so younger than Rachel. I still have memories of keeping Christmas. I had some good ones. I probably, even this many years back, I can remember about three or four of them pretty well that I had. And I remember looking forward to it. I remember one night standing up all night waiting for Santa Claus, staring out the window, and who knows how many hours I was awake. I know I was really put out that I didn't see him. I was really put out. But, you know, when I look back at my memories of Christmas, and some of them were fairly good, and then I compare it to my experience in Ambassador College, where for those many years, I was, in a way, living in a small section of the world tomorrow, that we were isolated from the world. We didn't have to put up with or hear about or know about any of the crime and the horrible things that were going on in the world. We lived a utopian way of life for those years. Everybody was of the same faith and the same purpose and the same mind. I mean, for those years, we got to see what it would be like to live in a society that was positive and outgoing and uplifting. And I can tell you, my memories of Christmas can't at all come close to what it was like to live in a world that was at peace and at harmony. You know, some people go to camp and they get to experience some of that for a couple of weeks, and that is true. And at the feast, we try to get a glimpse of the world tomorrow, don't we? But you know, at the feast, we are still in the society. We still have to go to and from. We still have to interact with the people of this world that are blinded. And so we do the best that we can. But you know, when I was in college, I spent 2 years at the feast in Big Sandy. And you want to talk about a feast that you would remember for the rest of your life, is a feast where not once did I go out to dinner at a fancy restaurant, did not stay in a hotel, didn't leave campus for the entire feast. And neither did anybody else, because there at the campus, everybody would camp. And they had the piney woods there, and you'd see 5,000 to 7,000 people camping for the feast. And they would be all out in the woods, and they would convert the airplane hangar out there in Big Sandy to a giant store. So they brought in all sorts of gifts, clothes, food, all sorts of items for people to enjoy the feast with. And the happiest people I've ever met in my life were the people that would come into that store spending the money that they had saved up all year for. These people look forward to the feast in Big Sandy because they got to leave the world behind for that 8 days. And it was the most amazing experience for those who have been there to walk up and down the streets of 5,000 people that are all camping out, feasting together, living in a world that is truly free from the pain and suffering that we see in the news. And so when you think about what people are trying to accomplish with Christmas, they're well-meaning. They really are. But if they could only know what is coming, they would never want to trade that for Christmas if they really understood it. And what's more, Christmas detracts people from keeping the holy days. I mean, you're either going to keep your holy days or you're going to keep the holidays. The next argument that was given was in reference to pagan origins, they had heard many in church say, it really doesn't mean anything to me. People in churches today who keep Christmas say, what if it is pagan? It doesn't mean anything to me. I'm not pagan. I'm certainly not bowing down to my Christmas tree. If I burn a Yule log, it's not because of this or that. I'll say Yuletide greetings, or I'll say this, or I'll say that. I sure like the mistletoe. I sure like this. I sure like that. So they say, many Christians claim that although the Christmas tree, mistletoe, Santa Claus, etc., don't mean anything pagan to them because they can exercise their Christian liberty to partake in it. He says, obviously one could, if one were to take such a cavalier approach to the physical world, for instance, I can drink rat poison because I choose not to regard it as poison. They probably wouldn't make it too long. He says, why would people think that avoiding spiritual lessons is going to avoid spiritual harm when God gives very definite warnings? Turn over to Romans 15. Romans 15 and verse 4. For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. You know what's interesting? When you listen to Christians talk about the Old Testament, they refer to the law that was done away with, that was nailed to the cross, that, oh, that law brought you to death. The new law brings you to life. And they have all this stuff that they talk about. But here we see Paul is talking about the things that were written before were written so that we could learn from it. And he says that they would have hope. If you didn't have what was written in the Old Testament, Paul says you wouldn't have hope. You know, it's interesting. Jesus Christ never once said the Old Covenant was bad. He never said it was evil. He says the New Covenant was better. If the Old Covenant was good, the New Covenant was better. And yet, they take the hyperbole and say, oh, well, if the New Covenant is better, then the Old Covenant is evil. Anything in it is bad. There must not be anything that you can learn from it. And they realize these groups are now starting to go back to the Old Testament and start to open up and see what it says and say, wow, if God says he hates this, then maybe he really hates this. It doesn't matter what it says in the legal argument. Some of these, I read about as far as the Lutheran pastor who says that Christmas wasn't pagan, it sounded more, when you read through all of that, that he was trying to get a defendant off for murder than it sounded like he was actually defending something that he believed in. It is really bizarre. You know, some look at the pagan origins and say, okay, there are pagan origins. We get that. We know all that. But then they say the connection has been broken. Those were pagan, now they're not. And he says, there are those who clearly recognize the pagan nature of various Christmas worship forms and practices. Nevertheless, many of these Christians claim that because the long passage of time from their pagan inception to the present, which is thousands of years, the connection to paganism has been sufficiently diminished to allow the adoptions of these forms and practices into our Christian worship and celebration. You know, you won't find that, you know, in writing in these churches. They won't come out and say, oh yeah, we believe that enough time has happened, you know, statute of limitations has gone past. But he says if you spend time in those churches and you listen to the sermons, that's what you hear. Oh, yeah, that was a long time ago. But, you know, we looked for this. There was one of the things I was looking at when preparing for this. He said, you could look at the Christmas tree as a bad thing, but you could also look at it as, instead of eternal life that they were looking for in the seasons and nature, look at it as the eternal life that God promises you. So they started inventing new things. The gift giving that you do, that Santa Claus does, is just a way of God giving his gifts to us. And you just assign new meanings to it. assign a new meaning to it, no longer a problem. There you go. That was used to sacrifice children. Now it means something good. Don't worry about it. While it may be true that most of these symbols have lost their demonic meaning and significance in modern society, it is strangely bizarre and ironic that Christendom seeks to commemorate Christ's birth with faded symbols of Satan. They're recognizing this. And even though some of God's people may be naive and ignorant about the source of these things, surely God is not. You know, if God condemned Israel for using pagan worship, following after their gods, mixing in some of the things, we know what happened to Solomon, all of his many wives that he pulled from the different nations, all worked to introduce different false beliefs into his life, and it caused no end of suffering in Solomon's life. But has God changed his mind over these many years just because time has passed? Even though people have forgotten the origins, God's memory is crystal clear. You know, I heard one person make an analogy, and although it's not perfect, an analogy, it really hit home. And he says, let's say you've got a newlywed couple. And so they get married, they buy a house together, and they move in. And the first thing the man does is he puts up pictures of his old girlfriend all over the house. He spends his time watching old movies of them together, and he routinely spends time reminiscing on his old life. What would that do to his relationship now, and how would his new bride feel? You know, we may not know in this world today that this, whatever it is we're doing, might have had this origin, whatever it was, but God knows. And he is just as offended by it today as he was 4,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. Because God saw the destruction of that kind of thinking. When you read through the Old Testament, you start to see that what God is talking about isn't trying to keep a certain group of people in line so that they could have some physical blessing. He was trying to teach them about a way of life. And that way of life is where that hope stems from. Turn to 1 Corinthians 10. Another scripture here talks about looking back to the Old Testament for what it has to offer. 1 Corinthians 10. We're starting in verse 5. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, talking about people of the past, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and to not become idolaters as some of them were. As it were written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Let us not commit sexual immorality as some of them did, or in one day 12,000 or 23,000 fell. And verse 9, nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor complain as some of them who also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all of these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. What it's saying here is we're not just picking out some idol worship from the past. Oh, if only they hadn't done the idol worship, they would have been okay. Here, Paul is talking about a way of life that God was trying to teach them. He picked a number of different ideas that weren't directly connected, but all wove a thread that the people of the Old Testament were trying to learn God's way of life. And when they didn't learn it, they suffered. So, even in the New Testament, whether you want to believe or not believe that anything was done away with in the Old Testament, it's very clear that the people of the first century church believed and understood that that which happened in the Old Testament was put there to teach us how to live God's way of life. The last item that was brought up as a justification for keeping Christmas But these people who no longer keep it would look back to you and say, wow, I can't believe they thought that way. Was this, all I am doing is putting Christ back into Christmas, and it's the reason for the season. The assumption here is that the celebration was invented to worship Christ, when in reality Christ was added to the celebration. The truth is that they are putting Christ into paganism. It should in reality be called Baal Mass, Nimrod Mass, Tammuz Mass, or Mithras Mass, but not Christ Mass. It was not the birth of Christ at this time of the year celebrates, and just because many were forced to become Christian as a result of Christmas doesn't make it right, and it doesn't make Constantine a saint for doing so. Why use a lie to prop up the Christian faith? The Bible is full of